listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the Holiday 2020-2021 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Here's the cover story. In Colbert, we trust. When the White House gave up even the pretense of truthiness, when the pandemic drove us inside and inward, Stephen Colbert made our late nights a lot less dark by becoming the rarest of things, himself, by Joe Hagan, with photographs by Annie Leibovitz. Opening photo, Lean on Me, Stephen Colbert, photographed for Vanity Fair in Red Hook, Brooklyn, on November 6th. And he's dressed in a suit, head leaning against a wall. The rest of his body away from the wall so that he stands at an angle. On the day before Joe Biden is declared the 46th president of the United States, before the country will joyously throw off the shackles of Donald Trump's reign of terror, Stephen Colbert is tired, very tired. "I really haven't slept this week," he says, "so I would cry at an AT&T commercial right now. My nerves are incredibly raw." For 4 long years, Colbert has been making comedy out of the tragedy of Donald Trump. It defined his show. It defined his monologues. It defined his jokes. It defined him. And now, in the excruciating hours of uncertainty, as votes are being counted in Pennsylvania on a Friday afternoon, and the nation grinds closer to resolution, the end seems finally, fitfully at hand. "You know King John's Christmas by A.A. Milne?" Colbert asked me, referring to the poem by the author of Winnie the Pooh. At one point he says, "Oh, Father Christmas, if you love me at all, bring me a big red India rubber ball." And I have been saying for weeks now, "Oh, Father Christmas, if you love me at all, just let me stop talking about this guy." In the purgatory of this moment, however, he cannot quite allow himself to feel happy. Not yet. "I have often said that happy is overrated," he says, sighing. "I'll take the sublime over the happy any day." And there is a sublime relief in knowing that our long national reality show may be coming to an end. But not yet. Talking to Stephen Colbert over Zoom is not unlike having a private version of The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. He's alone in a room, live from his home office, only a twinkle in his eye and shelves of sci-fi and fantasy books behind him. Wearing a baseball cap and black vest over a plaid button-down, he looks like the Elvis Costello of Elmer Fudd's, his dowdy suburban dadness a kind of comic exclamation point. During the weekend before the election, he's developed a condition called benign positional vertigo, which means when he stands up, the world goes off kilter. "It's almost entertaining until I forget," he says, "and then I go to stand up, and then I just fall down. So I'm coming to you right now from a very weird angle, slightly listing to port." From off camera, his wife, Evie McGee, enters the room to remind Colbert to do his prescribed vertigo exercises and ask what kind of sandwich he wants for lunch. "Egg, avocado, bacon," he says, "and while she's at it, throw some cheese in the MF." In recent months, McGee has become a familiar, if invisible, presence on his show, giggling at his jokes, or not, as when Colbert's pained grin makes clear she disapproves. "None of that shit's made up," Colbert says. After the nation went into lockdown last March, Colbert spent 5 months broadcasting from his home office in Charleston, South Carolina, where he grew up and still has a home, squeezing laughs from the daily horrors of sickness, fear, death, and Trump, and with only dead air for company. In these disorienting times, he has righted himself and his audience by becoming part comic first responder, part neighbor next door who can't believe this shit is happening. It's brought me and you, my audience, closer together, he had said the previous week. Before pivoting to a photoshopped image of himself in a lingerie ad, Stephen Colbert's intimate secrets. It's all a reminder of how little distance there is now between Colbert, the CBS entertainer, and Colbert, the guy stuck inside a room like us. No happy-clappy circus at the Ed Sullivan Theater to buoy him. The Zoomification of Colbert's show has made him essential viewing during 2020 chaos, from the long-form interviews, putting John Bolton in the hot seat, for instance, to the unexpected moments of grace, like when he cried as Dolly Parton sang Bury Me Beneath the Willow in split screen. Like a lot of Americans, I'm under a lot of stress right now, he said, dabbing his eyes. But the main ingredient has simply been Colbert himself, a one-man stage show of his elastic mind. And so now, observes his friend John Stewart, you're just watching a stair and a broom. You know what I mean? Ginger Rogers left the building. Colbert seemed made for this era. He was also prepared for it. Unlike the Trump administration, the producers of The Late Show had been paying close attention to the reports from Wuhan, China, and began whispering that they needed a contingency plan. They were like, it's 100% going to happen. We have to leave this building, Colbert recalls. And we just want to be ready when it happens. So we were. We had a plan in place. In recent years, Colbert's executive producer, Chris Licht, along with the producers of the other major late shows, including The Tonight Show, Jimmy Kimmel Live, and Trevor Noah's Daily Show, have created an informal club, meeting over dinner to socialize and talk shop. The prospect of a pandemic ripping everybody's programs apart began percolating in emails and text in February. Late-night wars were shunted aside. Colbert and Licht insist ratings battles have largely ceased. But for the record, Colbert has firmly won them, and now they banded together. We were all talking to each other in March like, what the F are you guys going to do, recalls Licht. We were all lost in the wilderness, and we all shared as much information as possible. So the producers prepared Zoom accounts, health protocols, plans for staying networked. In many ways, a MASH unit-style broadcast played to their strengths as comedians, because we are, by nature, improvisers, says Colbert. The night of March 12th was the last for late-night broadcast from theaters. Colbert decamped to his home in Charleston, where a satellite truck idled on his lawn. Since no crew members were allowed inside, Colbert's sons, Peter and John, home from school, and his daughter, Madeline, and his wife, became the de facto crew, managing the broadcast feed on laptops and using an iPad for a teleprompter. It felt much like the 19th century, says Colbert. Daddy's got a woodshop, and the kids are going to come in and help me cut the pine today. He did the first remote show from his bathtub, wearing a suit and tie under soap suds, with McGee holding the iPad and the producers punching in clips and comic slides remotely. McGee says she felt like Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible, trying to defuse a virtual bomb with only the faintest idea of which wires did what. I'm on the headset, and the producers are like, no, it's a small red one. Pull the small red one. I'm going, there are two red ones. But the biggest mission impossible fell to Colbert himself, who found himself alone in front of an unsmiling camera. The second night, live on tape from a safe distance, declared the announcer. He sat on a deck chair on his back patio, under overcast skies, stoking a fire pit and discussing the election primaries, with jokes like, this year we'll be awarding the presidency to the person with the most toilet paper. At first it was terrible, Colbert says, recalling a quote from his beloved Lord of the Rings. As Tom Bombadil says to Frodo, who are you, alone, yourself, and nameless? After taping a show, he would flop down on his couch and admit, I have no idea how to keep doing this. You'll figure it out, Evie told him. In some ways, this was a return to 2015, when Colbert first took over the show from David Letterman. The question that hung over him then was, without the mask of Stephen Colbert, the right-wing caricature of unearned privilege and toxic masculinity he'd performed on his Comedy Central show, The Colbert Report, who was he? And how could he turn his actual self, the earnest and erudite Catholic with the theater nerd giddiness, into something millions would want to scarf up like a bowl of American Dream ice cream at midnight? It was disorienting, a kind of performer's version of vertigo. Oh, it was physically painful at times to know that it's possible and not have the answer in your hand, he says, and to figure out what part of you and how much to put out there. Critics deemed Colbert's take on Late Night a flop. Ratings flagged, and he panicked. In the spring of 2016, then-CBS President Les Moonves suggested a counterintuitive idea. Hire Licht, executive producer of CBS This Morning, to produce. Licht had never worked in comedy and hadn't watched Colbert's show with much interest, but he recognized as a matter of television mechanics that it was unfocused. A control freak by nature, Colbert had curated every last detail of the show, but hadn't figured out how to retool his comic identity. Licht created a team of writers to work on the monologue, the core of the show's sensibility, which freed Colbert to focus on his persona. Then along came Trump. Colbert had been reluctant to go all in on politics, as he had at Comedy Central, but after Trump clinched the Republican nomination, his rise to power made it unavoidable. Colbert describes election night 2016, when he broadcast live on Showtime, as slowly having an ice pick pushed into my forehead. But he told his equally rattled audience, I am not going anywhere, promising to hold their collective hands, come what may. This wasn't merely a reformatted show. This was a purpose, and a personal one. His Comedy Central persona, a send-up of the dark impulses of his own white privilege, had suddenly materialized as a real person. The real Stephen Colbert birthed a character that spoke the thing he was most afraid of, says Anne Libera, a friend from the host days at the Second City in Chicago in the 1980s, and now he has to confront him. Trump, of course, offered a surf-and-turf platter of the kind of hypocrisy Colbert specialized in skewering. Subsequently, his ratings shot past the Jimmys. The at-home version of Colbert's show returned him to improv roots, when he trained with stellar comics at the Second City, working with close friends Amy Sedaris and Paul DiNello. The deafening silence of the late show at home was not unlike the horrible quiet after bombing in front of an audience. The very first note I ever got from my very first director at Second City, a guy named Jeff Mikalski, he said, you have to learn to love the bomb. I realized what he meant was not like survive when a joke doesn't go well, or feel okay, you'll get them next time if the scene you improvise didn't go well, but actually breathe in and love the bomb. love that moment of failure, which is incredibly useful if you're actually bombing. The absence of an audience revealed a weird intimacy, a connection to viewers as direct as two family members on a Zoom call, and that intimacy was something I didn't realize I missed until I got it back, Colbert says. It's less intimate to be in front of 450 people who are all laughing, and you've got a band, and there's this beautiful space, and you're standing, and the camera's 25 feet away from you, not 4 feet away from you. I mean, literally, the camera is as close as you are right now. McGee returns with the lunch. "Where's my avocado?" Colbert asks his wife, lifting the bread to peek inside. "Oh, F," McGee says, "we don't have any avocado, and I gave you the last egg in the house." "Oh, thank you very much," he says, brightening. "Are you going to eat in front of him?" "I am going to eat in front of him. That's so rude." "Sorry," he says, taking a delighted bite. "It's hot." Colbert and McGee, both from Charleston, have the familiar comic rhythms of a working marriage. They're both suburban provincials who venture to big cities, he to Chicago, she to New York, where she tried her hand at acting and absorbed the arts and cosmopolitan worldviews, but never lost their basic Charlestonness. When they met, Colbert and McGee bonded over this dual citizenship. It's that duality in Colbert, the double persona of an everyman and a send-up of an everyman, that has been his comic stock in trade, a style indebted to Steve Martin and George Carlin, both Colbert heroes. When McGee met Colbert, he had already developed sketch characters that became the building blocks of his persona, like Rand Manley, perfect in every way, and a clueless NPR reporter character based on Noah Adams. His earnest fascination with the news was just beginning as well. As McGee recalls, it was during the Anita Hill hearings in 1991 when Joe Biden became a controversial figure for barring testimony from women who had accused Clarence Thomas of sexual harassment that Colbert began tuning in more closely to politics. "We were going to some party, and he was like, 'No, we can't go inside,'" McGee recalls. "We just sat in the car for an hour, listening to the hearings." Ironically, it would be Biden, nearly 25 years later, who helped define Stephen Colbert after the Colbert Report. On the third episode of Colbert's Late Show in 2015, he featured the first interview with the then vice president after the death of Biden's son, Beau, from brain cancer. The interview was something of a debut for an irony-free and deeply earnest Colbert. He opened by describing to Biden why he thought people liked the vice president. "I think it's because when we see you, we think that we are actually seeing the real Joe Biden. You're not a politician who's created some sort of facade to get something out of this, or triangulate your political position or emotional state to try to make us feel a certain way. We see the real you." It was almost explicitly what he himself hoped to achieve. Colbert says he and Biden had frank personal conversations off camera before the interview. After Biden spoke about Beau, he turned to the host's own personal tragedy. The youngest of 11 kids, as Colbert rattled off to Mark Maron last year, Jimmy, Eddie, Mary, Billy, Margot, Tommy, Jay, Lizzie, Paul, Peter, and Stephen. Colbert lost his father and two brothers, Peter and Paul, in a plane crash in 1974. He spent part of his childhood alone with a mother who wore black every day and was consumed with grief. Colbert turned to science fiction and fantasy books, and later to acting and comedy. He was inquisitive and dorky, but also on a spiritual quest to sort through his inner darkness. Anne Libera, who introduced Colbert to the Second City comedy scene and produced his first one-man show, says Colbert had terrible nightmares about waking up as a skeleton. In the late 1980s, someone on the street handed Colbert a Gideon Bible, and he read the Sermon on the Mount, which clarified his Catholic worldview, though he sanded the more conservative edges off. 5 years after Colbert bonded with Biden, that worldview and that understanding of loss helped define Biden's campaign as well as Colbert's show. Empathy and intelligence were the sling and stone the host used against Trump's Goliath size, spiritual vacancies. It's the Christianness of it, but it's also the Catholicness of it. Joe matches the moment because the moment is about loss, but loss is not the same thing as defeat. Colbert has helped fundraise for Biden's campaign this year and has been open about his political sympathies on The Late Show, bringing Biden back for an hour in May. What he sees in Biden is a quality Trump obviously can't comprehend, the power of accepting loss. Joe Biden, literally, when I interviewed him and I said, "What do you think it will mean if you lose?" He goes, "Maybe I'm a bad candidate," recalls Colbert. What a victorious answer. It shows enormous confidence. The message of Christ isn't that you can't kill me. The message of Christ is you can kill me, and that's not death. At the end of their conversation, Colbert asked Biden a question that echoed Colbert's promise to his viewers back in 2016 to see them through the Trump years. Colbert, "Are we going to be all right?" Biden, "Yes, we are." Last August, Colbert and McGee moved back to their home in Montclair, New Jersey, so Colbert could broadcast live from the New York studio during the Republican and Democratic conventions. But Colbert took the lessons of his home show with him. Unlike Jimmy Fallon and Jimmy Kimmel, who've created socially distanced versions of their old stage sets, Colbert converted a spare office above the Ed Sullivan Theater into a simulation of his home office. "The stage is only there to present a show to a live audience," he says. "That's the only purpose of the stage. And it's some weird lie to be on stage without the audience. I actually did a shoot on stage last week, just basically still photography and promo shoots for our Showtime Live Election Night special, and I went, 'Get me out of here, it's weird, it's like a ghost house.'" Like his viewers, Colbert has leaned on his own emotional ballast to get through these strange days, whether it's his wife and family or his audio lectures on J.R.R. Tolkien, but he mostly relies on his team of 10 comedy writers. The staff's daily morning meetings on Zoom have turned into a form of therapy, and partly by design. Colbert and his staff share their personal reactions to the latest atrocity on the news, whether it's the killing of George Floyd or the protracted election, before turning them into comedy. A lot of times, Stephen will start that meeting by checking in, going, "What does this mean to you? How do you feel?" says Tom Purcell, Colbert's longtime head writer. "This allows them to build some truth," Purcell adds, "and then you can start to do some jokes on some of the insights." "I feel less alone when I hear them pitching these jokes," says Colbert. "I always feel better after that meeting's over." He says the pointed comedy he's done over the last several months, like his searing monologue on the 545 children separated from their parents at the border, might have been impossible in front of a studio audience. Individuals at home or in small groups can receive this material in a much more raw state. You can get as dark as you want within your own ethical guidelines, without the concern of how you kill the vibe of a room. "As much as I want my audience back, and I desperately do, it would be extremely difficult to talk about what's going on in the world right now to a group of people who normally have a party atmosphere." A prime example came the night, 2 days after the election, when Trump held a press conference to unleash a series of outright lies attacking the results as illegitimate. Horrified, Colbert knew what he had to do, even if it meant stepping fully outside his role as a comedian. God, I just felt like I was on fire, and I was so mad. With most of the show already taped, he outlined his reaction to his writers, who quickly produced a script, and Colbert stood in front of the camera and delivered a nearly 8-minute speech. Breaking down for a long and riveting moment, he declared himself heartbroken for democracy. "It is extremely rare that you have to be that honest," he says. "That was one of the horrors of the moment of his election. I went, oh no, now there's no escaping him." Next photo. Colbert sits in an old-fashioned floral upholstered armchair, and he's sitting with the cushions on top of him so that all you see are his arms and legs. And there's clashing floral, very tacky, wallpaper in the room and parquet floors. You can tell that he's wearing either shorts or has his pants legs rolled up, socks on with no shoes, and a long-sleeved shirt. Colbert's pointed honesty and his empathy have made him the most important mainstream comedian of 2020. Important? He recoils at the word. His mandate is to opine on the national conversation, not make news. It's interpretive. It's editorial. It's not instructive. And it's not even leadership. It might be emotional leadership. A decade ago, when Stewart and Colbert held a rally in Washington, D.C., entitled Rally to Restore Sanity and or Fear, a critique but also a rejoinder to Glenn Beck's political rallies, some critics felt it was the first sign that the kings of Comedy Central were taking themselves too seriously. Stewart, who left The Daily Show in August 2015 and became something of a recluse while he produced independent movies, also expresses ambivalence about late-night comics being leaders. "I think that's a difficult road to go down, because moral leadership requires a great deal more effort than monologuing," Stewart says. But maybe Colbert's basic decency and worldview have supplied something essential. I mean, look, there's not a lot of guys that you can sit down with, and in times of kind of existential crisis, they can go to the Bible or Lord of the Rings or Khalil Gibran with equal facility and with accuracy. Like disturbing accuracy. Whenever I go to him, I'm like, "Are you my friend, or are you an SAT proctor? What are you reading this off of?" However you describe Colbert's role, the show has been more vital than the one before. Maybe that's because he has more fully realized its mandate. Colbert recalls a talk he had with director Spike Jonze in 2015. When Jonze asked him what he wanted the show to be about, after thinking about it, Colbert remembered a line from E.E. Cummings. "What is more important than love, which is the only God who spoke this earth so glad and big?" "And I haven't the slightest effing idea how to do that, okay?" he says. "How can you make it about love? For the life of me, I did not know how to do it. I just kept on doing it and doing it. What has occurred to me since Trump became president is that what the show is about is loss, and you feel it with such clarity, because you're losing something you love, which is, however illusory or real, because I'm not going to judge either way, America's moral authority in the world, that shining city on the hill. Our own national image gets lost," Colbert continues. "Our own sense of the purpose of America gets lost. And then there's economic hegemony. Then there's a loss by white Americans thinking that they are the default culture of America. There's all the loss that the people who've been denied their position or their rights in America have always dealt with. that then we have to deal with, which is also another sense of loss and innocence. There's all this loss going on in America, and on a nightly basis, because there's no audience, I can talk about loss. But what I'm really talking about is, look at what we love. It's on fire. Is the fire out now? When Biden was declared president-elect on that sunny Saturday in November, Colbert sent out a single tweet, a bittersweet quote from Tolkien, and all the host laughed and wept, and their joy was like swords. And they passed in thought out to regions where pain and delight flow together, and tears are the very wine of blessedness. On the late show the following Monday, he popped a bottle of champagne. It's as if America is, what's the word, great again. And even Toasted Evie, who for a moment appeared on camera smiling, "You've been a rock these last couple of weeks," Colbert said. With Biden in control, the country may become sleepier. Ratings might collapse across the media without the Trump circus. And Colbert has lost his biggest and most show-defining target. But he says he couldn't feel happier, or at least by his own standard of happiness, more sublimely relieved. If Joe Biden is a pair of khaki pants inside a manila envelope, that would be great, he says. I actually don't think you need to think about politics all the time, and one of the things I'm looking forward to is not. Colbert is reluctant to imagine how he'll wring comedy from a Biden administration, though he's developed an impersonation, wearing aviator glasses and a crooked smile to gently mock Biden's vintage machismo. But there are things that the host wants to take with him from the Trump years, especially the intimacy with his audience. While eating lunch, Colbert holds up a piece of bread his son baked, a product of the sourdough bread craze during quarantine. Even the fact of this damn bread that I'm eating right now is intimate, and it's beautiful in its ordinariness, he says, displaying it in front of the camera for me. It is proverbially common, and what we have discovered doing the show is some sort of commonality with the audience. I ask Colbert to envision what the late show will look like a year from now, when there might be a vaccine. What would be the show of his dreams? The first thing I picture is I have an audience, he says, and John Batiste and the Stay Human Band are there, and our offices are buzzing every day, and we're all passing each other in the halls and saying, "Did you see this story? And how was your weekend?" And we're laughing, and we're hugging, and we're friends hanging out, which is what we are. There might be echoes of Trump. He might be something that never fully goes away. He's like herpes. There might be blossomings of him where we have to take Valtrex. We have to take the Valtrex to keep the Trump blossoms down. Colbert has handled uncertainty before. "I am diving straight headlong into it when I say we're going to improvise," he says. "How do you do a show from home? Impossible. You cannot do 200 hours of comedy from home with no audience, not on your own, on a computer." Until, of course, he did it. That didn't make him unique. It just made him one of us. "We're not special," he says. "Everybody's done it." The Oracle of Brit. In 2008, Britney Spears entered into a conservatorship, her father and the courts control her life. Now, what started as an internet meme has grown into a serious movement to hashtag Free Britney. By Haley Phelan. It was the summer of revolution. Statues were toppling, buildings renamed, and day after day, hundreds took to the streets demanding change. In late July, outside the Stanley Mosque courthouse in downtown Los Angeles, dozens of protesters had gathered under an unseasonably cloudy sky. They wore masks and brandished homemade signs. They chanted, they sang, they marched. They were young, they were diverse, and they meant business. "What do we want?" a man dressed in an all-black and combat boots called through a hot pink loudspeaker. The response was uproarious. "Free Britney." The group had gathered just blocks from City Hall, where weeks earlier many of the largest Black Lives Matter protests had taken place. But this was a different movement, a small but growing one, a movement that believes Britney Spears is trapped in an immoral and possibly unlawful conservatorship, and it's up to them to save her. The facts. In 2008, following a very public mental health crisis, whose shaved head is burned into the psyche of many millennials and Gen Zers, Spears, then 26, had control of her welfare handed over to her father. Depending on the state, it's a conservatorship or a guardianship. Jamie Spears was authorized by the California Superior Court to control his daughter's finances, health care, and aspects of her daily routine. The conservatorship was initially temporary. 12 years later, it's still in place. The court documents and hearings, there have been many over the years, have been mostly sealed to the public, so little is known about the actual nature and conditions of the agreement. We know that Jody Montgomery, whose website describes her as a licensed fiduciary, has been acting as Spears' temporary conservator since September 2019, when Jamie had to step down following colon surgery, according to People magazine. We know that 1 year later, Spears' lawyer, Sam Ingham III, filed a petition to keep Montgomery on, stating that his client was strongly opposed to having her father as her conservator. We know that during the 12 years she has been under conservatorship, Spears has been working nonstop. She released 4 albums, went on as many world tours, and for her successful Piece of Me residency in Las Vegas, played 248 shows in the span of 4 years. Grossing $500,000 per show. We don't know whether Spears wanted to be on stage or in the studio, whether she's happy, whether she's well. Where there is mystery, humans will look for answers. Victorians had tea leaves. The early 20th century had the Ouija board. Hippies had the tarot deck. Gen Z has social media. For many of Spears' fans, the answers to her truth can be found within the neat grid of her Instagram account, if you look hard enough. What appears to the uninitiated as a random assortment of selfies, inspirational quotes, and dance videos is, according to supporters of the so-called hashtag Free Britney movement, a desperate plea for help. First, there was the color of her shirt, which appeared to match commenters' calls for her to wear yellow, or red, or blue, or white, or anything, if she were in trouble. Then there were the roses, a symbol of secrecy and silence, as one user pointed out. In one video, Spears walks back and forth 9 times, obviously Morse code for SOS. And then, of course, there were her eyelashes. "To my knowledge, I was the first to see it," said Isis Johns, a 17-year-old in Pennsylvania. What she saw were the words "call 911" written in Spears' lower lashes on a recent Instagram. According to Johns, she never paid that much attention to Britney Spears. "Sadly, I was one of the many who wrote her off as crazy. But then Johns came across a TikTok that exposed the severity of her lack of free will, and she started to get interested. I did some searching, and she mentioned eyes in the caption, so I thought to myself, there must be a message. Johns shared what she saw in the comments section, and soon thousands of Spears fans were seeing it too. As the theory picked up steam, the inferences spiraled. One fan noticed Spears had a slight gap in her teeth, and others began theorizing that the woman posting isn't even Brittany. She had been killed and replaced by a clone, but they couldn't get her teeth right. Brittany's boyfriend, Sam Asghari, was controlling her account. A man is definitely posting these, noted one commenter. When it appeared that Spears had started an Instagram live video from Asghari's account, a 3-second snippet in which Spears is not visible, but allegedly can be heard saying, "We're live," before Asghari reaches for the phone, her fans went wild. "Something isn't right," wrote a commenter. Asghari put up an Instagram story explaining the incident. "My girl, accidentally sick, went live since the new Instagram is confusing," and he meant accidentally. "Plausible," said some Spears fans. "Too plausible." To understand the hashtag, we have to go back to 2009. Jordan Miller sat down at his computer fuming. For the past week, he'd been updating his Britney Spears fan site, BreatheHeavy.com, on the pop icon's conservatorship. The news was making him irate. A story that Spears' cell phone had been taken away from her sent him over the edge. He tapped out his fury and hit upload on a post that would inadvertently give name to a movement. The headline, "Prisoner, Forbidden Phone Privileges." "That is so rude," Miller tells me now, laughing. "Keep in mind, I was a teenager." He was 20 and had been managing BreatheHeavy.com since he launched the site at the ripe old age of 15. I would never write it that way now. I must have been just outraged, like, "This is an injustice. How can you take away Britney Spears' cell phone?" Miller ended the post with an imperative that would have consequences. "Open your eyes. Free Britney." Though it wasn't the first time he had used this phrase, and wouldn't be the last, Miller remembers feeling the true gravity of Spears' situation as he wrote the post. The term kicked around the internet mostly among fan sites, but only Spears' super stans seemed to pay it any attention. Then, in April 2019, Miller got a call from Tess Barker and Barbara Gray of Britney's Gram, the podcast. They gave him a heads up that they were planning to title a forthcoming episode hashtag Free Britney, and it was going to be a bombshell. A man had called into their podcast line and left a voicemail, claiming to be a former paralegal on the Spears team. According to him, Spears had been ordered to take medication she did not want, and later was locked up in an institution against her will. "What is happening," said the man, "is disturbing, to say the least." Britney's Gram had started almost as a joke, but the tongue-in-cheek analysis of Spears' Instagram had morphed into a personal crusade for Barker and Gray. "The real shift occurred when I was researching something for the podcast, and I came across a petition that her former conservator, Andrew Wallet, had filed seeking a raise," said Barker. "It didn't seem that being someone's conservator should be a for-profit position. California law allows conservators to collect reasonable compensation." Shortly after, Barker woke up early one morning, put on a court shirt, and headed to the hearing for that raise, the lone media person present. At that point, I was like, okay, maybe this is more than a comedy podcast now. While the claims made in the voicemail have not been substantiated, Gray and Barker, who has a background in journalism, said they did verify the man's identity. Spears' camp has remained silent on the issue, and no legal action was taken against Britney's Gram, which Miller thinks is telling. and thousands of Britney's fans had taken note. Hashtag Free Britney began trending on Twitter. A movement was born. The irony of conspiratorial thinking is that any explanation to disprove it only becomes further proof that the theory is true. That is why conspiracies can be so hard to dislodge. Take QAnon, the far-right group that believes a government official with Q-level security clearance, codename Q, is feeding information via Q-drops on various message boards to prove liberal Democrats are secretly running a child sex trafficking ring and Donald Trump is the Messiah, come to put an end to it all, drain the swamp. To believers, Hillary Clinton's dismissal of the theory that she is running a secret sex trafficking ring is only proof of her guilt. Q's anonymity, far from being suspicious, is evidence he really is who he says he is. Hashtag Free Britney is sort of like QAnon, but for young, celebrity-obsessed liberals. There is the same deep distrust of the media, a preoccupation with helpless victims, and the righteous belief that the movement is the only thing standing in the way of total disaster. At the center is a hallowed figure whose digital missives warrant intense analysis. QAnon allows followers to become active participants in the evolving conspiracy theory narratives as bakers, who puzzle over and figure out Q's breadcrumbs, says Joe Pierre, a clinical psychiatric professor at UCLA who has studied the far-right conspiracy theory group. It sounds like part of the appeal of hashtag Free Britney is that followers can likewise imagine themselves as fans doing their part to rescue Spears, as if she's a modern-day Rapunzel trapped in a tower by evil forces and desperate for a champion. Britney Spears' volunteer force of Dragon Slayers had gathered that day in July because Jodie Montgomery's term as her temporary conservator was reaching its end, and the court would soon have to decide whether to appoint a new conservator. Though the hearing would take place over Zoom in accordance with social distancing practices, said Kevin Wu, 36, "We are here as a symbol to let them know we're watching. I just want to put the fear in them," said Sesco, 42, who had come to the rally wearing a homemade Dia de los Muertos full-face mask, complete with shaggy, glittery gray hair. They, according to Sesco, were the powerful players taking advantage not only of Spears, but all the children we don't know about, the ones who go missing, the ones at the border who are trafficked and sacrificed to money in the USA and all around the world. Hashtag Free Britney and QAnon actually share a common thread through the hashtag Save the Children, hashtag Save Our Children theme, with both narratives threaded into concerns about human trafficking and child sexual abuse that currently exist on both sides of the political divide, says Pierre. He notes that there is a long list of cognitive quirks that have been found to be associated with conspiratorial thinking, including needs for closure, certainty, and control, need for uniqueness, bullshit receptivity, and lack of analytic thinking, and teleologic bias, or the tendency to think that things happen for a reason or some higher purpose. But he is also careful to point out that these cognitive quirks are not necessarily abnormal. Everyone can be vulnerable to conspiracy theories, particularly if we mistrust authoritative sources of information, and if reliable information is not forthcoming or not easily discernible from false information. Considering the veil of secrecy around Spears' conservatorship, it's only natural that fans would begin to wonder what is going on. From there, it's surprisingly not too far a jump to believing they have the answer. Human beings are particularly good at finding patterns within random noise when there's sufficient motivation to do so, he said. Also, he added, conspiracy theories do occasionally turn out to be true. In fact, as the sun began to peek out from behind the clouds and Wu started a new march around the courthouse, unseen forces were shaping events and exerting control. According to TMZ, the hearing was infiltrated by unknown members of the public, or Zoom-bombed, forcing the judge to end the session. "I was one of the people given information about it, but we don't really know what happened," Miller told me. In terms of if they were hashtag Free Britney activist, that sounds like a great story, but I don't know anything about it. You have to think, though, he added, how were fans able to hack into the court system? And why wouldn't the judge just kick them off and tell them to send a new link or whatever? Why would she have to wait another month to have the hearing? While the media fingered hashtag Free Britney as the culprit, some within the movement suspect the media. "We don't know who they were. We just know that it was Zoom-bombed by hackers. That's it," Wu said. Wu has his own conspiracy theory about the conspiracy theories. "I do think there is an incentive for the conservators to steer the narrative toward these conspiracies in an effort to discredit the movement," he said. I asked him if he thought it was possible Spears was using her own social media to send messages to her fans. "I do, but I think the alternative is just as likely that this is just the game her social media team is playing." Opening photo for this article was a close-up of Britney Spears looking intently into the camera. Next photos, isn't she lucky? Britney Spears alongside her parents at a Planet Hollywood event with Justin Timberlake at the American Music Awards in 2001. Contact sheet image from a 2000 shoot with photographer Art Stryber. The truth behind Britney Spears' case may be stranger and sadder than any theory. It does strike us in the legal profession as strange, says Lisa McCarley, an estate planning and probate attorney based in California, of Spears' conservatorship. McCarley hasn't worked with Spears, nor has she any connection to the ongoing conservatorship, but the case caught her attention nonetheless, and recently she's been joining in at the rallies to show support. Even up in Sacramento, when I talk to legislators, they say, "What's going on?" Nobody understands it. Spears' case is being adjudicated in probate court, which typically handles the conservatorships of elderly people with cognitive disorders like Alzheimer's or dementia, and people with severe brain injuries. In other words, people who are not likely to get out of the conservatorship. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selection by Mark Hoffman.